This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stacio. Ever since he can remember, Sanka Johnson has been caught between two worlds, art and science. Growing up, he captured documentary photos on the streets of Pittsburgh and developed them in a homemade darkroom. He drew pictures and wrote creative stories, later practiced and taught modern dance. His love of art led him on a surprising path towards science. Today, he's a professor of biology at Duke University. He plunges thousands of feet under the sea looking for mysterious marine animals that hide in plain sight. He uses his gifts to capture photos of these rare animals and to weave together stories about life under the sea. Sanka Johnson joins me on the State of Things right now. Thank you for being with us.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Your whole life, you've had your foot in both worlds, and we shouldn't, you know, sort of create this binary, but they do strike us as different approaches to finding the truth, art and science. There's always been a common thread, though, and that is the need to create something. Maybe you can take us back to those early days for you in Pittsburgh, where your parents, who emigrated from Germany, right, were fairly creative in how they brought you up, right?
Yeah, so my parents were both born during World War II in Germany, which left them, you know, with a lot of scars, but it also left them with an amazing ability to do things for themselves. You know, there was very little in Germany after the war or during the war, and so what you needed, you had to make yourself, grow yourself, or whatever else. And so when we came to the United States, we came with even less. I mean, whatever we had built up in Germany as a life, we packed it into two steamer trunks and literally came over on an ocean liner and then moved into an apartment building. And at the time, we had just some cardboard boxes for furniture and so on. So the first thing my dad did was to build a couch. He got some wood from a friend. He figured out how to get it into the living room, managed to get some tools, and slowly put together the wooden frame of the couch. And then my mom busily started making the cushions and sewing the upholstery and so on it. And they still use this couch. 50 years later, I mean, that couch is still sitting there. And they did that with everything. I mean, they built the other furniture. My mom went into pottery, and so she made the pots, the bowls, the plates, the cups, the mugs, and so on. She started painting things for the walls so we'd have artwork. She started putting together all kinds of clothes and sweaters and so on. And then we moved from an apartment to a house with this tiny little garden. We started growing our food. Which was not easy in Pittsburgh at that time with the pollution and so on.
Yeah. Because food needs air.
Food needs air.
In Pittsburgh at that time.
Yeah. Not a lot of air. And my dad would just keep – he was a physicist. And so he would bring home things and he would repair them and then we would get to use them. And he would just – he walked to and from the university and he would pick up things on the street. So at the time, you know, we had very, very little money. But we had seven telephones, which was unheard of, you know, back in the early 70s where Ma Bell controlled – everything, and you got one phone, maybe two.
Right.
And we had seven because people would throw them out. My dad would grab it, take home, tinker on it, and we'd have another telephone. We had like five television sets because he was piecing them together. I remember days where I'd come down to the basement and there was the entire engine of a Volkswagen Beetle, which he was like busily taking apart, retuning to stuff back in a car so we would, you know, have a car. So it was a remarkable optimism, I would say, in that anything that really needs to be done, you can do it.
Now, you can grow up in, if you're in the United States of America at that time, you're talking about the 1960s at this point,
60s
right?
and 70s, yes.
60s and 70s, and growing up American as you were, that kind of DIY ethic is pretty cool and you have to admire it, but maybe not cool for a young man growing up. Did you have a sense that that's not common in your neighborhood, or did you have any sense of being an outsider because of that kind of stuff?
Definitely felt like an outsider. I think any time you come from another nation, particularly a nation that's just come out of a war, you end up sort of caught in this bind between, you know, the way your parents have lived and the life they want for you and how they see you growing up and what the world around you is. And so that, you know, got to be confusing and difficult. You never really, or I never really felt like I could really solidly live in either world. And we did have very, very little money, which, and I think that's the main thing that sort of ostracized me is, you know, as much as my mom would keep up with clothing and so on, you know, my long pants weren't terribly long. You know, they sort of only make it halfway down my shin. I had a paper shopping bag for my backpack to take, you know, things to school. And, you know, people, especially kids, they really focus on money, and we didn't have much. And so that was a difficult aspect of it. The actual building of things, that didn't ever end up being a real conflict or anything, except that the things we had were always so different. You know, so for example, my grandmother every year, who also was very good at building everything, and she would make us all these clothes. And she would make them in a classic 70s German style, which was like lots of pinks and oranges and reds with a giant pocket sewn into the very middle of your chest. And you try wearing that in Pittsburgh in like 1974, where everybody's wearing, you know, a dark blue or black, you know, heavy metal T-shirt and a pair of jeans. And there you are with, you know, grandma's like, you know, bright red and purple sweater with the pocket in the middle. So yeah, we.
I don't know if you spike your hair, you could sell it as cool, but I guess you're saying that wasn't really.
Yeah, we couldn't quite pull it off.
You did pick up the creative vibe, and you and your brother lived in pretty close quarters, and you were engaged in art at a pretty early age, right?
Yeah, I mean, for us, it was just, you know, we were always doing something, and it didn't really matter if it was like we were doing something sciencey, like my dad would bring home a lot of like lenses and literally like chunks of metal and weird rocks and so on from the lab, or actually mercury. He once brought home a bowl full of mercury, and we would play with that. And so that was sort of sciencey, but at the same time, you know, my mom in particular would have us also, you know, doing things with ceramics, painting, drawing, you know, doing things on the walls, whatever. And for us, it was just all the same thing. You know, it was all doing stuff.
Yeah.
It was all, you know, creating. We never really thought of in terms of, oh, this is science, you know, this is art. It's just all like, this is our latest bizarre project. Like, you know, we dug a coal mine in the backyard, you know, to see if, you know, and then we start sorting out the coal by the different types. It was a real Pittsburgh kind of thing.
You were probably just living on a slag heap. But
we were actually, yeah. So, you know, the slag heap had all the different coals.
There you go.
It was very nice.
When in elementary school, though, you did have a sense of being in a scientific world, or developing a love for biology. Am I right about that? Elementary school, maybe?
Not biology, actually. Funny enough, it was physics. Yeah. My dad was a physicist. I always said, you know, my whole life I've like been escaping being a biologist, but, you know, now I've become one. It's perfect. But as a child, yeah, I was very much into sort of the most like non-biological things possible. I was interested in, you know, deep, deep space and, you know, huge stars and supernova, and sort of physics, you know, cosmology, things of that sort. I sort of imagined, you know, I'd be a physicist like my dad, and, you know, I would have a lab with my own fusion reactor like his, and, you know, I would go work in it. Biology was a tough sell in Pittsburgh. I mean, Pittsburgh was not very biological. It had a few miserable little trees, this sort of browny, slimy-ish kind of grass, a couple squirrels. We would try so hard to grow things.
They've since left to Cranberry, I think.
Yeah, it's so hard to like really appreciate the natural world and find a love for it, that I found sort of a love of things like the stars, even though you couldn't actually see the stars. Yeah. I mean, we would go out with my dad and I at night on the clearest night we could find, and the sky was just orange. You know, there were no stars. You could see the moon, maybe. So, yeah, science was definitely in there. I sort of imagine myself as a future physicist or astronomer.
Did you start to – what about when you got into high school? Did you become more active then in pursuing science?
Yeah. I mean, I was – at that point, I really developed like a love for math. Yeah. Math, funny enough, for me was a way to relax. I know for a lot of people it's really not. You know, people have math phobias and so on. But for me, whenever I would feel tense or unhappy – I would sit upstairs and do calculus, believe it or not. I mean, it sounds so horribly dweeby to even say it, but I loved it. I loved sort of the beautiful elegance of it. And I liked the way the equations looked and the formulas and the symbols and all that. It was just, it had like its own beauty in addition to its own structure. And so, yeah, funny enough, in high school, I was what they call a mathlete. Another terrible term that's guaranteed to get you punched in the face in high school, where we were actually a small math team that our math teacher would drive us around the state in her old Buick and take us to these different colleges and other campuses where we would meet other high school mathletes and do puzzles and, you know, try to beat each other out. So, yeah, at that time I was very again, just sort of interested in sort of math, physics-y part without any real biology.
Were you imagining at that point what you were going to do? Did you were imagining a career?
Yeah, I was. I mean, I was, again, my father was always a real role model for this. Even though, I mean, I was interested in other things too, you know, these other sort of parts of the arts. The part of the arts I loved the most at that time was photography, and it was my dad that got me into that. He was always just a wonderful, beautiful photographer. And he got an old door, and we had an attic bathroom that was just a terrible, useless thing, but it had a tub. And so he put the door on the tub, and then he, again, fixed up a bunch of old, useless darkroom equipment, some of it from the 50s, and we had a darkroom, a black and white darkroom. And he gave me an old camera from the 1950s from Germany, and I would go around town and photograph. And for me, that was a wonderful mix of sort of art and science because, you know, the camera itself, you know, there's optics involved, there's the machinery of it, the engineering. But at the same time, you know, I could photograph people and try to get into their heads and into, you know, arguments between, you know, couples on streets or, you know, particularly unhappy person or a little kid just extremely happy with a game they were playing. And so for me, I could kind of try to merge them together, you know, in this one craft, I guess.
We'll find out about a bunch of mergers, including modern dance and biology and art, as I continue my conversation with Sanka Johnson today on the State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Please stay with us. This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stasio, and I'm talking with biology professor at Duke University, Sanka Johnson, today. We're going to get you under the water and talk about your research there pretty soon, but I'm still more interested in the moment at what you were looking for. Now you talk about doing some photography, having your own darkroom, and this kind of documentary impulse that you had looking at the faces of the people in Pittsburgh. I mean, did you really started imagining stories or trying to tell stories through these photos?
Yeah, I think at heart I've always been very interested in stories. For a while, I even, you know, wrote fiction for a while. But I've always been, you know, I read stories, of course, growing up. But, yeah, just to know what's going on inside, you know, the life of another person. And then that became extended, you know, to life inside of animals, actually, to get inside them. For me, that was always, it just, like, meant a lot to me to see see if you could crack sort of what's going on in there. And photography was like that, especially, you know, with the weird little cameras I had, you know, nobody would even recognize them as cameras. They were so odd and strange. I could just hold them at my waist. And so you could really get these sort of unobtrusive shots of people and what was going on.
Have you kept them? You still have the pictures?
Do
you
still have those pictures? Yeah, no, I still got them. Yeah, I mean, they're very old school, you know. Yeah. They're on negatives, you know, in little slide files and so on. I mean, not many of them are even digitized, but yeah, they're still around.
We went to a liberal arts college for university. Again, tell us what you were planning and where you went and what you were doing there.
Yeah, so I just always in the back of my mind had this sort of career plan. I was going to be a physicist. And so I showed up, started taking some physics classes, and was horrified to discover that actually only being a physicist did not grab me. I mean, I loved talking to my father. I loved learning physics. I loved reading about it. But actually, taking the classes, it didn't do it. And in retrospect, that was a real shocker, you know, to build up this whole life. And all of a sudden, it's like, oh, I don't want to do this. So I needed a major in something. Yeah. But I also wanted to explore and figure out, you know, what I really cared about. And so I chose the major that I was good at that also required the least amount of time, which was math. I could do math and I could do pretty much my whole week's worth of math in a couple hours, which left me the whole rest of the week to explore. I mean, literally explore. I would put a backpack on my back and just start walking down the train tracks sometimes to see what would happen. I got into these sort of weird performance art things where I would be rearranging things around campus or making gigantic smiley faces and mounting them on 10-foot wide clocks on campus and so on.
Making them from what?
Oh, just way up on the towers, up on the thing. I would get in a lot of trouble. They would come find me periodically. And I took art class after art class after art class. I took sculpture. I took painting. I took drawing. And I got completely sucked into modern dance, of all things, which totally came out of nowhere.
Well, tell us the story, because your how you found modern dance was a story in and of itself.
It was a gym credit. My college required that you have a gym credit, and I didn't really want to take any of the things they had. And I've never been like a great athlete except for swimming, and I really didn't want to swim anymore. And they had folk dance. I'm like, okay, folk dance is nice, and, you know, maybe I might get a date or something out of it. And so I did it, and a few classes in, there were these two women who showed up, and they were obviously doing it way better than everyone else. I mean, they were just moving in this amazing, just sort of beautiful way, and I was like, wow, that's really cool. And I found out that they were actually, you know, taking modern dance classes. And so the next semester, I signed up for that and just became completely hooked. Which was, yeah, for me, it came out of nowhere, like I said, because, I mean, Pittsburgh growing up, you know, being a dancer is definitely not something you ever admit to even thinking about, let alone doing. But by, you know, about a year into it, I was doing it about 20 hours a week. I was doing performances. I'd, you know, sign up for different choreographers. We'd drive up as a group to, you know, to Manhattan to see other people, you know, famous dance troupes perform. And it just, you know, became a big part of my life.
Were you imagining a possibility as a professional
dancer?
I was,
actually.
Yeah?
I really was there for a while. I'd sort of, you know, given up on, you know, the whole math science thing and decided, you know, one way or another, I was going to have a life in the arts, which would likely require some sort of a day job. And so I started to cultivate my ability to have a day job. I got good at doing carpentry and things like that from what I already knew as a kid, and thought, you know, I would just be this sort of free-forming artist where I would be writing short stories, I would be painting, I would be, you know, dancing in a troupe and, you know, working also on stage sets for different, you know, plays and so on, and that I would make just enough money. And I didn't need much, and I knew that from being a child, that you don't need much. You can get by with very, very little, and that this would be my life.
Now, how did your mom and dad feel about this?
They were cool with the art part, not so much with the dance part. For them, and they're actually, you know, quite liberal in many ways, but for them, they associated dancing entirely with being gay, which I wasn't. But they really strongly associated with it. And I remember, you know, I needed a unitard, and it cost too much. It cost like $100, amazingly enough. You know, for one particular class, they told us that we had to have it. And my mom bought it for me. And I still remember her standing on the stairs, and she handed it to me and says, you know, I'm giving you this because I love you, but I never want to see you in it.
So how did you, how did you take that? I mean, you're imagining this will be some part of your life. Were you difficult for you to think that maybe I could never perform for my parents?
I was all right with it.
Yeah.
You know, I was, you know, I was okay with that.
And you were getting jobs. I mean, the fact is that at the time, there weren't as many male dancers in modern dance, and so you're getting parts.
Oh, yeah. No, if you're a male dancer, you know, life's pretty easy for you because it's something like, you know, 80% women, right? And so, yeah, I could get, you know, these things, you know, for different choreographed pieces and so on. Yeah, it worked out pretty well. You live like an entire life. Yeah. In your body, which for me, you know, was just a wonderful feeling.
Wonderful feeling, though you did sustain a few injuries.
Yeah. That's, for me, in some ways, that's what killed it is I'm pretty long and skinny and double jointed. And it turns out if you're running through the air and catching people who, you know, weigh about 100 pounds or so over and over and over, your legs and feet don't really like it after a while. Mm. And so, yeah, I broke a lot of bones, particularly my feet. You know, I just remember these times where I would land and I would just hear this crack. And I'm like, oh, and it would be in the middle of some performance. And so I would just roll underneath a table in the corner. And the dance would just sort of go on without me. And they'd come find me later. And, you know, with my big black swollen up foot, you know, take me off to the emergency room again. So I sort of imagined, you know, this life as a dancer, one, it being incredibly competitive. You know, only a few people really, really, you know, get to enjoy that the way they want to, and that I would just keep breaking things. And eventually, you know, every time it rained, I wouldn't be able to even go outside because I would be in so much pain.
You did, though. You kept the odd jobs, and you taught dance for a while, right?
Yep, to little kids.
So talk about that. And is this is after you've graduated now? You've got your undergrad. You're done with that. Mm-hmm. And so what are you doing? You're doing odd jobs and teaching?
Yeah. I sort of left college having absolutely no idea what my future would be. All I knew is that, you know, at any given moment, I had enough money to get by. I had friends. I had a girlfriend. So, you know, everything seemed good. But the jobs were very random. I worked as a freelance carpenter on a number of different, you know, little projects, you know, install a washing machine, paint a garage, paint a house, you know, build some shelves, repair a kitchen, so on. I did some programming because I learned how to do that in high school. I taught dance to little kids. I scarily enough ran a daycare center for a while with two other women and 75-year-olds. It was terrifying. I taught kindergarten for a little while. I taught first grade.
Now, at this point, does this worry you, or is this a comfortable life? This can be the life, right?
I never thought about it. It's interesting because, you know, I teach now, and my students often are worrying about their future from a very young age. You know, they're thinking, you know, I've got to get good grades in high school so I can get good grades in college and be in a good college, and so then I can get to med school and get in a good hospital and so on. All I was really concerned about was making enough to eat.
But let me stop you there. Let me stop you right there, because that is not the American way. Mm-hmm. And I wonder to what extent you've been able to reflect on that now that you are a highly successful biologist and scientist whose work is cutting edge. You show up in a lot of publications, popular and academic. By this route, again, coming from a tradition and a background where all you needed was enough to eat, I can make my own sofa. Living in a culture where that's never enough, where enough is never enough, where status is everything and the kind of next new gadget identifies you, it becomes your identity. Have you thought about how you are over and against that kind of culture and how different that is here? And is that an obstacle for people? You're describing students who come to you with all this anxiety and they got enough to worry about.
Yeah, for me, I've never thought of it as a negative thing. It's enormous freedom.
Yeah.
It's enormous freedom to not need very much. If you can get by, you know, without the latest clothes or the latest, you know, this or that or gadget or having a particularly nice apartment, you have the freedom to do anything. And I meet, you know, periodically with students in different capacities at Duke, and I talk about this. My topic of conversation is always about dreams. You know, what are your dreams and what's getting in the way of your dreams? And I try to instill on them the fact that the world is not that terrifying a place, you know, particularly here. I mean, there are places where the world is truly terrifying. But here, you know, especially, you know, at Duke University among the students, you know, it's pretty nice. And their futures are fairly assured, but they feel so concerned. And for me and my friends at that time, we never cared. I mean, it's funny to think back on, but we just didn't. And it was wonderful. It was such a wonderful, freeing feeling.
Well, and it kept your mind open enough so that you can do the kind of work you do now. There was a moment, though, on one of the jobs that you did, a carpentry job, that did cause you to go back and inspect what you were doing and maybe think through your future a little bit. You can tell us about that job.
Yeah. There was one sore point to this whole life plan I had, which was I don't like being told what to do. I always, you know, had a fairly healthy ego, thought I was pretty smart, thought I was pretty capable. And the life I was leading always involved doing what somebody else told me to do so I could get the day job and have the money to live. And we had this one job. My friend was living in a house, and the person owning the house said, you know, they'd like to have some work done on it. And it was a really big project. It was going to pay us, you know, a few $1,000s, which for us was a lot. And so he brought me on, and we worked on it all through that summer. And the man actually worked all the way in Manhattan or something like that. And so his wife was there during the day. And we slowly realized over that summer that she was suffering some sort of mental collapse from some mental illness, you know, a fairly serious one. She just became increasingly agitated. And at one point she came out while we were working and accused my friend of plotting to murder her. And he was heartbroken. He was this very, very sensitive guy. I mean, he had like the beard and the shaggy hair and all those things people had back then, sort of sensitive guy. And it just broke his heart. And he's like, I have no idea what you're talking about. And she was like, well, you know, that's the sickest part of all of this. And we were just, our eyes just got really large. And this was in a neighborhood where people, you know, had guns. And she went back in, we assumed, you know, to get a gun and finish at least my friend off, if not me as well. And we ran for the car. We packed up all the tools we could get in the next minute. We had this beat up old Geo Metro, and we had actually installed 2x4 bumpers on it because it didn't have bumpers. And we got into this thing that looked like out of a Flintstones, you know, show, and just drove like crazy out of there. And went up the highway, and we decided on this trip back to my girlfriend's apartment that we needed a little more respectable jobs where we could actually chart our own destiny a little bit. You know, we didn't need the money, we didn't need anything else, but we needed a little say-so in our lives. And we went through the alphabet. We didn't know what else to do. We had no idea. So we just went through the alphabet back and forth, you know, sort of naming out letters. And I started with A and, of course, immediately thought of art and then imagined I'd be right back where I was since this was sort of what I was doing right now and I'd be, you know, still in trouble. And I couldn't think of any other good word that began with A. And so I went to B, and the first thing came to my mind was biology. And I'd never taken any biology courses that really stuck except one in college that I thought was really funny. I'd had some fish in high school, and I just loved it when we went to the beach and we went to the mountains as a kid, and that was my only real exposure to nature. My mom was a doctor by this point, and so all these things sort of floated around my head, and I'm like, okay. And my friend, he actually stopped at E for education, and he's an education professor now, so it was apparently a very useful
If you got technique. Up to F, do you think you'd be a fishmonger now? Or, well, no, that's you never got there.
Yeah,
never
I know. We always say, you know, if biology had still been called zoology, you know, I wouldn't be doing it, right?
You'd still be figuring
Something
it out.
Else in there would have jumped in the way.
So you ended up going to grad school at UNC Chapel Hill, right?
Yes, yes.
And that was for biology?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. All right, so tell us about that, because that had a kind of a panicky moment as well.
Oh, I had a few panicky moments. I went, you know, to find a couple of people to talk about where I should go to grad school, and they were nice enough to give me some names. And there was a guy, you know, at UNC. He studied things like elephant trunks and, you know, combined physics and biology. And so he was interested in people who knew physics but maybe could still, like, learn biology. I applied there and Duke University and University of Chicago. And I was shocked. I actually got into all three, I think only because I knew, you know, the physics and the math, not because I knew the biology. And chose UNC. It seemed, well, one, the person I'd be working with seemed really, really friendly. And the building had windows, which I really liked. The weather was better than Chicago. And it just seemed like a friendly, sunny, good place. I got a good feel about it. And so I was going to show up. And then a day before I showed up, I panicked. And I wrote my advisor, and I said, I'm not coming. Maybe I'll see you in a year. And this guy, he's the most patient man alive. He said, okay. And a year later, I did show up and had no idea what to do.
Wait a minute. What did you do in that year?
I drew pictures of bugs on the lawn. I sat on the lawn between the two biology buildings, between Coker and Wilson Hall. And there were bugs sort of in the grass, and little insects and so on that I really liked. And I just started drawing. And the other professors would just walk by and laugh at, you know, my advisor. Said, well, you chose this guy. All he does is draw bugs. I broke my advisor's microscope. Mm-hmm. I flooded the lab several times. I was about as bad as they could get. Yeah. And they would make me teach. I mean, they had me teach introductory anatomy. And I had no idea what I was doing. I was just standing up there reading frantically ahead of them to, you know enough. But I had this lab mate. He was another grad student, the only other grad student in the lab. Very good biologist, incredibly well prepared, real serious guy. I mean, he would chew through these pencils. He could be so tense. And he initially was really annoyed by me, but eventually he would talk to me. And he would tell me all these neat stories about the animals and so on. And I just really started to really like it. And so then at one point, and this was like 9 months into it or so on, I went into my advisor's office. I still remember doing this. And I was like, Bill, I think I actually like biology. And, you know, to his credit, he just goes, well, that's good. I think he'd hoped I'd liked it already. And I said, I have a religious feeling about this. And I'm not a traditionally religious person, but feel very strongly about things. And yeah, just something, it was like a conversion moment, that period there where all of a sudden I realized that, you know, this is what I need to be devoted to.
Was it the stories? Was it something about the way the stories got into your head?
It's like life is the ultimate family story. Mm. You know, at root, we are all related. Mm. You know, all of us, you know, everything down to like the lowliest bacteria, we're all related. And it's like the ultimate family tree story. I used to love those stories like Anna Karenina and so on, you know, the Russian novels where you just keep following this family through descent. And then this is essentially what we're doing as biologists. You know, we're following this enormous family that's terrifying at times and awe-inspiring and hysterically funny in other periods and just incredibly diverse and huge in every way at every level. I mean, there is more going on in one cell than any of us will ever hope to know, you know, in an entire lifetime. And we have uncounted numbers of cells and animals of all different types and all different ways of thinking about it. And to me, it was like, oh my God, you know, this is a world that I could get lost in, you know, forever.
And you did, at least forever up until now. And we'll get you to tell some family secrets when we return with Sanka Johnson on the state of things. And that will happen on the State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio. You know the deal, and you'll be back in just a minute, I hope. Stay tuned. This is the State of Things. I'm Frank Stasio, talking with Duke biologist Sanka Johnson, who explores the oddities of marine life. So tell us now how you got interested in that particular branch of biology and what got you started thinking about that and studying it.
Oh, about the marine world?
Marine, yeah.
I love the beach. To be really blunt, like I mentioned before, Pittsburgh was a natural desert. And the only times we really got to escape is we went for 2 weeks to the beach every year. And every now and then we went to the mountains, which was much less common. But for 2 weeks guaranteed in the summer, we would go to, you know, this little cottage court, you know, where each of the little cottages really, I mean, they just look like one of those little public bathrooms you see at parks, like the cinder blocky sort of things. You know, miserable little un-air conditioned thing, but it was right on the water.
In North Carolina.
In North Carolina, yeah. At Killdevil Hills.
Yeah.
Not far from the Wright Brothers Memorial. And we would just be out there, you know, in the surf and the waves and the dunes and all the, you know, the funny little critters that would wash up and all the shells. And for me, this was just magical. And yeah, and there's just something that has drawn me about it. My parents often also say it's, you know, my roots. My dad was born on a seaport up in Germany on the Baltic, and that it's just like in your blood, you have to love the ocean. But those beach trips, I mean, they just pulled me in.
Your research now focuses on optics in animals, and you're out at sea several weeks every year, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so tell us a little bit about this, because I think this business of the cloak of invisibility, how animals hide, I know that your research focuses on more than that, but let's start there. Mm-hmm. It's sort of the trick of hiding 20,000 leagues under the sea. Tell us about what sort of...
Yeah, so the ocean, like the real ocean, like away from the coast, is a completely different thing than what we actually think of as the beach. So we go to the beach and the water's murky. It has that real particular smell to it. And, you know, mostly if you see anything in there, you see, you know, some fish and so on, and maybe some sharks around here. But you go away from the coast, you know, to this part that's actually like, you know, the majority of our planet. And it's just this incredibly blue, clear water where things are very, very easy to see and where there's nowhere to hide at all. If you are some poor little animal and... something's coming to get you, you have nothing you can do. You can't just like dive into a little hole on a reef. You can't go down your little burrow. You can't mimic a plant. You're just like out there completely exposed. And most of the things, if you're a little prey animal, you're slower than whatever's coming to get you. And so you're doomed once you're seen. And so it's a wonderful laboratory for understanding how to hide. And they use all these different mechanisms that we just don't see on land. Or on a coral reef. So on a land or a coral reef, we see animals that hide using color. You know, they make a nice little camouflage pattern on their body, and or they look like a plant, or they look like a rock, or they look like a sponge, things of that sort. And you see that all over the place. But in the open ocean, you see all these other tricks that are almost magical. You see them. They use mirrors. They use transparency. They use lights in ways that can make them look like water.
bioluminescence, they can light themselves
up.
Yes,
they can
right?
light themselves up, and sometimes they need to do that to hide.
And this is even trickier because it seems to me that on water, in the water, as opposed to land, you've got sort of any time you change your perspective at all, you change your aspect with respect to the predator, everything, so whatever trick you had might not work as well. A little glint, a little hint of, I don't know how much light we're talking about down there.
Oh, yeah. No, that's a real problem. And that's why actually some of these tricks have apparently evolved because they do work from a lot of different angles. So if you are completely clear, you know, you always match the background because the animal's looking through you at the background. It works really, really well. And the way the mirrors are designed so that pretty much every angle you look at them from, they still sort of hide you very, very well. And the same with the lights. The lights are a very sort of complicated system that are designed actually to just hide you from many different points of view.
Now, the cloak of invisibility, mm-hmm. it seems to me, should be just great for all of us. Why don't all pray? And if we want to even stick with the creatures you focus on, why don't they all have that? That seems like the most successful option if I had to just pick one. That would be my superpower if I was a sea creature.
Oh, to be transparent and invisible?
Well, yeah.
It comes with a lot of costs. Mm-hmm. So on land, there are a number of biggies. One is, so when you look at an ice sculpture, well, imagine like an ice cube. If you have an ice cube and you put it out in the air, you can actually see it pretty well because all kind of light sort of bounces off right. of it. You put it in a cup of water and it's a lot harder to right. see. And this is because there's a property of an object called the refractive index. This is what lets a lens focus light. And the refractive index difference between animal tissue and water is pretty small compared to the difference between tissue and air.
Mm-hmm.
And whenever that difference is big, you get a lot of reflected light. And so something like an ice sculpture at a wedding or things of that sort, just tons of light flashes
right.
off of it.
Right.
And so if we walked around trying to be transparent, we would be clear, but you would almost, you'd stick out like
you'd
an
be,
ice sculpture. We'd
obvious.
Look like a bunch of walking ice sculptures.
Yeah.
Another problem is that to live on land is to live against gravity. When an animal lives in the ocean, there's really no gravity to worry about. And so they don't have to worry as much about bones and structures of that sort. And bones are one of these things that are pretty hard to make clear.
Yeah.
And so if we wanted to live, you know, transparently on land, we'd be blobs. And another biggie is UV damage. When you're up in the air, there's an awful lot of ultraviolet radiation. And if you're transparent, that just shoots right through you. I mean, we're quite well protected. I mean, we often don't realize it. But our skin, even when it's getting burned, is sort of taking a hit for the rest of the body.
Mm-hmm.
We really don't want that UV light to go all the way inside our bodies. We sort of like hold our skin out as like the sacrificial lamb in a way. And so a transparent animal on land would just be beaten to death by UV radiation. So the costs are very high. It also makes you slow. It makes you more delicate. There are a number of different things that just make it a not very happy solution, particularly on land.
But it works down there pretty well. You've got some other great stories about some of these creatures, including a crustacean that seems to coat itself with bacteria. Tell us about
that. Yeah, that's a funny project spearheaded by one of the students in my lab. So again, you know, a problem when you're clear, even underwater, is that light can bounce off of you. I mean, you can think of this like if you go around with a flashlight at night and you shine it against a window pane, you see some light coming back, even though it's clear. And this is a problem underwater. And it's actually a problem in particular for people who design camera lenses, like those nice Nikon lenses and so on. And if you've ever looked at one of those ones closely, you'll see that they do reflect light, but it's sort of like very dim and it's sort of purple or kind of greenish. Right. And they put these coatings on things like glasses and so on. It's a special coating. Very, very thin coating, extremely thin, that stops the light from being reflected. Instead of it being reflected, it just keeps going on into the glass and makes the reflections a lot less. And so this would be a useful thing to have if you were a transparent animal. And so it looks like, you know, this one group of animals, they're particular sort of shrimpy-like animals that are pretty big and clear. They're a few inches long in some cases. They actually grow their own anti-reflection coating. or at least they allow themselves to be colonized.
I was
going to
say, is it a colonization? Is it microbes from other animals that then inhabit them?
Yeah, so there are bacteria in the ocean, in the ocean everywhere, these little, in particular, these little round guys, really quite small. And they form on these animals these biofilms. And the animals, these particular shrimp, the biofilm is an extremely convenient sort of shape and set of, instead of just being like a big pile of bacteria all piled on top of each other, like the biofilms, let's say, in our gut, you know, that help digest some of our food. They're a perfect, thin, flat, single layer of little spheres that are all exactly the same size. So it's one, you know, species of bacteria. They're perfectly laid out flat. And it looks like the animals have some control over this because they don't grow over the eyes. And the end result, when, you know, you actually sort of work out the physics of this, is that they're the exact right refractive index and thickness to reduce pretty much all the reflected light from the animals. So they're sort of farming their own invisibility cloak.
Well, but and think about that, because not only did the shrimp or the crustacean have to evolve its structures to be mostly invisible, then evolve whatever it took to live with this other thing, because I'm sure there's a bit of a cost, right? The bacteria has to feed off of it or something. The bacteria had to evolve also. I mean, it didn't just show up. They didn't just meet one day and say, hey, this is a pretty lucky group. Let's shake hands, sign the contract, you get on my back, and we're pals. The bacteria had to evolve in order to be that perfect layer, one sheet, stay away from the eyes. I mean, that all
could
had
be,
to happen.
Yeah.
I mean, do you think, or did they just sort of was a chance meeting down there?
It's hard to know. I mean, you know, we never know with these things because we can't really rewind the script. And there are some ways to analyze it that, you know, we're thinking of looking into. So, yeah, it could be just an amazing piece of luck that this works, but it's a pretty amazing piece of luck.
Yeah.
When we did sort of an analysis of what would be the perfect properties, and it's a fairly large set of, you know, possible things that could happen, only one small region where it's perfect, and they land right on perfect. So look, probably not. So it does look like, you know, there's some sort of, you know, either symbiotic or what we call a commensal relationship where, you know, they're not really doing each other any harm, but somehow, you know, they're working together. So, yeah, it's hard to know. I mean,
And also the rate at which this happens, because it seems to me that if it happened too slowly, like one generation after another, a little bit more, a little bit more of this, you'd all die, right? I mean, in the meantime, other fish are eating you. So don't you have to get at this genetic, this evolutionary jump much more quickly than it would take one generation after another?
Not necessarily, because there's a nice gradation.
Yeah.
So having just some coating helps. Maybe it doesn't help for all colors, or maybe it doesn't help as well. So, yeah, in this case, actually, there would be sort of a smooth way of getting there where you don't have to have, like, too big a jump.
You also look at cleaner shrimp, right, that signal other fish to stop. Tell us more about that.
Yeah, so this is one of these neat interspecies interactions. You know, most of the time when we think about one species and another, we think about they're either competing or just one, frankly, eating the other.
Mm-hmm.
But in this case, these two species have a relationship. Where these shrimp, a lot of times they live in little anemones in small groups, and then a fish will literally drive up. It looks like that because they're swimming just above the bottom, and they will stop. And the reason they stop is that a few of those little shrimp come up, and they have these long white antennae, and they start wiggling them in a really special way. That's almost like a signal, you know, come here. It's kind of like when people are cheering on the side of the road, you know, for a lemonade stand, or come, we'll wash your car.
Your car wash.
Very much like that. It's like they're waving the car wash sign. And the ones that don't have the antenna, they have these long white arms, and they clap. It's really adorable. And then the fish stops. The fish changes color, and it's like this little pair of signals has been exchanged. Then the shrimp approach the fish and, like, start opening up the gill area, opening up the mouth and so on, and they clean it.
It's a pit stop.
It's a pit stop. They're cleaning the car. It looks for all the world like a pit stop. It's adorable. And so, you know, one of my students is very, very interested in, you know, this sort of two-way visual communication. And a really funny thing about it is these cleaner shrimp they're beautiful. They have all these little colors. They have these little thin white antennae that they wave. You look at them, you just think, wow, these are really pretty cool. And, of course, these cleaner shrimp have to theoretically see these fish coming in and so on. And so the first thing we did was we looked at their visual abilities. We assumed that they would have wonderful color vision, that their vision would be pretty sharp. And they're nearly blind. They have no color vision whatsoever. And their vision is so poor that, you know, the person with the worst, you know, glasses in the world, you know, still would see far better than these guys do. Everything to them looks like a blob. Like you just 5 feet away from me, would be completely unrecognizable as even an object. I mean, let alone as a person or a human or an animal.
So what are they detecting? How do they know each other?
We don't know how they know each other at all. And it looks like the signals on, you know, that they have on their bodies, their white antennae, the patterns are entirely for other animals to recognize them. So I always sort of think of it as like, you know, this beautiful ballet dancer with a nice little costume dancing out this whole thing that they never get to see because they're blind, but everybody else can watch it.
And was this something that you all discovered, or had you known about this and then you tried to focus on it for your research?
We knew that cleaner shrimp had been known for a while, and a little bit about the signaling was known. Nothing was known about their visual abilities at all. It was assumed that their visual abilities might actually be pretty good. And like I said, a little bit was known that, you know, they sort of live in these little groups. But sort of the signals and how it goes back and forth and all that, no, that's what one of my students is sort of busily working on now. She goes to them, does some work in the lab, but then also goes to Curacao and the Red Sea and other places to watch them in nature do their thing and brings back tons and tons of GoPro videos.
How do you think your artistic sensibilities and experience inform your work or inform your approach to the work that you do now?
Yeah, for me, yeah, it matters a lot. Sometimes I feel a bit out of place as a scientist because I'm really drawn by the aesthetics of a question, more so often than any practical use. Though, funny enough, some of my things have ended up being very practical. You know, we do a lot of work that has ended up helping people with cataracts and so on. But I'm always drawn to things by their beauty, the underlying story, sometimes the, you know, the visual element of it. And so I choose things based on my own sort of love of it as an interesting thing, which maybe isn't that unusual, but we really a lot of times just don't take a very practical approach. And in the actual doing it, we do have a bit of a closet agenda that we want, you know, to sort of incorporate some art into the science in terms of the presentations, in terms of the figures we make for papers, in terms of movies and so on. We try to give people more than one way of understanding something, you know, to sort of do it in a beautiful way, because not everybody responds well to just like a speech or responds well to a number of equations. Some people, they need to see it. They need to see it acted out. They need to see it shown in a visual way.
But I wonder about your assumption a second ago that if you approach it maybe in a not very practical way. I wonder how cleaner shrimp practically approach their job. It's something about the attraction to each other that makes the thing work, and whatever their thought about the practical outcome seems less important than the fact that they were attracted. Can that apply to science and art as well? And, you know, sort of let nature sort it out. Like, I was attracted. Let's follow the attraction, and then we'll find out how this thing plays out. We'll let some researcher write the paper and explain to us why my attraction to this thing or this person actually yielded a very practical result.
Yeah, my mom sometimes talks to me about something like this. Because we talk a lot about, we both have this sort of, like, deep appreciation of nature, and she sometimes describes it, like, as a symphony. And she says she actually doesn't want to know how the symphony works. For her, learning more, and it's sort of funny, actually, because she was a doctor and quite a good one. For her, actually understanding how bodies work sometimes, or particularly how brains work or how some things in nature work, kind of takes away from it. She just wants to sort of see it, you know, sort of as it is.
Well, I'm happy that you tell us what it is and how it works. Sanka Johnson, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Sanka Johnson is a professor of biology at Duke University, and this is the State of Things. Thank you for listening. We've got more information at our website, stateofthings.org. North Carolina Public Radio is a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.